Good afternoon and welcome to the meeting, the second August meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. A particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. We're in our 31st year. Since 1983, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the foreign service or academia, international businessmen or journalists or think tanks, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Dean Chang. His topic, Asia, the Three Knots. That's N-O-T-S, not K-N-O-T-S, though it might as well be K-N-O-T-S. Dean brings detailed knowledge of China's military and space capabilities to bear as the Heritage Foundation's research fellow on Chinese political and security affairs. He's written extensively on China's military doctrine, technological implications of its space program, and dual use issues associated with the communist nation's industrial and scientific infrastructure. He previously worked for 13 years as a senior analyst, first with Science Applications International, the Fortune 500 specialist in defense and homeland security, and later with the China Studies Division of the Center for Naval Analyses, the federally funded research institute. Before entering the private sector, he studied China's defense industrial complex for a congressional agency, the Office of Technology Assessment, as an analyst in the International Security and Space Program. He has appeared on National Public Radio, CNN International, BBC World Service, and has provided commentary for Time Magazine, The Washington Post, Financial Times, Bloomberg News, Jane's Defense Weekly, South Korea's Chosun Ilbo, and Hong Kong's South China Morning Post. So it's terrific for us this afternoon to welcome Dean Chang to the Midcoast Forum. And I want to especially thank him for bringing summer to Maine, finally. Dean.
Well, good afternoon. My comments today will be about the three knots that confront U.S.-Chinese policy. U.S.-Chinese relations are marked by the realities that Asia is not Europe, that China is not the Soviet Union, and this is not your father's People's Liberation Army. So when we say that Asia is not Europe, the aspects here begin with the following. The Cold War isn't over in Asia. Although the wall came down in 1989 and the Soviet Union dissolved and the Warsaw Pact went away, that only marked the end of the Cold War in Europe. Germany reunified. But of the four nations that were divided during the Cold War, three of them were in Asia, and two of them remain divided even today. The Korean Peninsula between North and South Korea, and China between China and Taiwan. Second of all is that the end of the Cold War writ large, which, as I said, hasn't ended in Asia, also didn't end most of the tensions within Asia, because the Cold War was an overlay over broader issues that really didn't occur primarily due to ideology. So for example, unlike in Europe until very recently, the boundaries in Asia are not set. In Europe, you had the Helsinki Accords, which basically said, no matter what you might think, no matter whether you're happy about it or not, Alsace and Lorraine are now French. And we are not going to allow, and we will all agree not to use force to change those boundaries. The Sudetenland is Czechoslovakia, is now the Czech Republic. If you want to divide, like Czechoslovakia did peacefully, into two separate countries, that's your business. But you cannot use force to alter the boundaries. And this is one of the reasons why the Crimea is such an important issue, is that it does mark a change in that. But in Asia, there is no Helsinki Accords. There is no equivalent. And so throughout Asia, there remain fundamental disputes over where are the boundaries. Between Japan and Russia, there are the Northern Territories, also called the Southern Kuriles. Between Japan and Korea, there's the issue of Dokdo or Takeshima. Between China and Japan, there is the Diaoyutai or the Senkakus. There are multiple claimants to the South China Sea. And the reality is reflected in the fact that you cannot even agree on what these pieces of territory are called. If you call it the Senkakus, that means you're coming down on the side of the Japanese. The Chinese don't refer to it as the Senkakus, they refer to it as the Diaoyutai. Let me note here, for the purposes of this presentation, the Heritage Foundation, of which I am an employee, goes by the standard policy that we use whatever the United States State Department uses. So please don't take my comments or my particular preference in terminology as necessarily reflecting a partisan stance in this regard. But the point here is that there are geographic disputes throughout Asia. And these are not necessarily just involving China. So, but this is a reality that colors everyone's perceptions. And along these lines, geographic boundary resolutions will also have ripple effects. Part of this then in turn goes to the fundamental reality that, unlike Europe, Asian history is not predetermined. What happened in Nanking? Japanese textbooks have one version, Chinese textbooks have another. What was Japan's administration of Korea like? Again, Koreans have a somewhat different recollection than Western historians do, than Japanese historians present. So even the very foundations of looking at the world, the context, the framework within everything is structured, varies between countries. You know, there's the old saying, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. That's true. But what if there isn't fundamental agreement on the facts? That is one of the realities that marks Asia. And the consequence of this is that, again, unlike Europe, Asia has no overarching regional architectures. The most obvious example is you have NATO in Europe, but you have no NATO equivalent. CETO went away after the Vietnam War. There never was anything that covered Northeast Asia. But it's not just military. You also have no equivalent to the European Coal and Steel Community, or the 1958 Treaty of Rome, which created an economic foundation, which eventually grew into the European Economic Community, the European Common Market, today the forerunner of today's EU. So at an economic as well as a security level, you have fundamentally separate, very different perspectives. Instead, Asian security is built upon bilateral relationships. For the United States, we are the linchpin. The region often refers to this as the wagon wheel of relationships. You have the U.S. as the hub, and you have spokes, the U.S. and South Korea, the U.S. and Japan, the U.S. and Thailand, the U.S. and the Philippines, the U.S. and Australia. But among the Asian countries, there is no formal alliance relationship that ties together these countries. And this goes back millennia. Europe was long marked by balance of power. What was that? That was major powers, Prussia, Austria, England, Russia, France, jockeying with each other, forming alliances to counter the rise of any single hegemonic power, whether it was Napoleonic France, Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union. In Asia, Koreans and Khmers never allied against the central country, the Middle Kingdom, China. You never had the Vietnamese and the Japanese allying together against the Han or the Tang Dynasty or the Manchus. And so instead, even today, what you have is this wagon wheel, and we link together these countries in the hopes that in the event of a major crisis, they will cooperate with each other, hopefully, but that they will cooperate with us rather than perhaps aiming their guns at each other. Sometimes when you, however, look at tensions across the Tsushima Straits between Korea and Japan, again, the emphasis is on the word hope. China also prefers bilateral relations, and we see this in the South China Sea, because being the biggest kid on the block, literally, both economically, in terms of population, in terms of military capability. It prefers bilateral relations because it can then better pressure the neighbors. And so there isn't really much incentive among the Asian countries, whether because of history or because of ongoing tensions or whether because of political realities, to create some kind of regional security architecture to replace the bilateral relationships that mark the major countries' perspectives on the region. If Asia is not Europe, China is not the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a global military power. There were Soviet squadrons in the Mediterranean, Soviet bombers flying up and down the U.S. East and West, the U.S. East Coast, Soviet submarines out at sea, an Indian Ocean squadron, etc. It was an ideological opponent of the United States, as much as it was a political opponent. It presented the ideology of communism. It was a communism that said that the world should be communist and it should follow Moscow's lead in particular. And it was economically autarkic. When you're a country that spans some seven time zones, you can all actually afford to not trade with anybody else. And for the Soviet Union, it really didn't have to trade with too many people and it chose not to. It absented itself from the global economy. In every one of these respects, China is different. China is not a global military power, at least not yet. It is a regional military power. It can project its capability and its military influence several hundred miles offshore. It is extending that range. But as of today, for example, there are very few Chinese forces or Chinese bases overseas. The most persistent presence is the anti-piracy squadron, two ships, two combatants and a replenishment ship off the Gulf of Aden. And that's been going on for about 6 or 7 years, but that's it. There aren't Chinese military bases, for example, in North America. Second of all, China today represents very minimal ideology. The Chinese Communist Party, what does communism mean in a country that has over 100 billionaires and several thousand millionaires? The story goes that there has been this persistent seismic rumble in Beijing, and what they have finally traced it down to is Mao's body spinning in its grave. This is not a, the Communist Party of China today means communism in the Leninist sense, the vanguard party, the only political authority in the country. But the old Mao-era ideology of everything is owned by the state, you know, everything, you know, to become rich is suspect, and will probably bring down the pressure of the security police, went away in the late 1970s when Deng Xiaoping said, to become rich is glorious. And China has set to becoming rich with a will. But this is not that kind of ideology. And so as a result, whereas the Soviet Union was intent upon exporting ideology, China is far more intent upon exporting t-shirts, washing machines, and computers. And this goes to the most important difference between China and the Soviet Union. If the Soviet Union was autarkic, China is economically linked, integrated, tied in with the rest of the world. It is the world's largest trading power. It has eclipsed the United States in terms of how important trade is to its economy. So this is a very different country, and that has distinct implications for US-Chinese relations, because it was possible to contain the Soviet Union, in part because the Soviet Union contained itself. The Soviet Union, by choosing not to pursue economic links with the rest of the world, meant that if you contained it, there was very little in the way of opportunity cost. And let me just take a side note here to say that opportunity cost is perhaps the single most useful economic concept out there. If you spend a dollar on X, it's not available for Y. This is one of the things that's not clear the Soviets actually understood very well. But capitalism, at some level, means if I'm going to buy a sofa, I'm not going to be able to put that same money towards a couch. And so for the West, if you contain the Soviet Union, you didn't create a body of companies, interests, and people whose oxen were being gored. How would you contain the world's second largest economy, the world's largest trading partner? How many countries would say, yes, I am willing to sign up to contain China, even if that means that they won't buy our copper and they won't sell us furniture? That's a very, very hard thing to do, because there are going to be interest groups, whether you sell soybeans or airliners or computer parts or copper or lithium, in terms of a willingness to contain your largest customer, your largest supplier. In this regard, China, moreover, is in many ways a tougher opponent than the Soviet Union. The Chinese, not only would it be harder to contain them, but frankly, they have a very different approach towards relations. The Chinese are very good lessons, are very good students of history. When you have 5,000 years of history, you have a lot to study. And one of the things that they have taken away from the end of the Cold War is that they will not allow themselves to be spent into the ground on military capability the way the Soviet Union was. As it turns out, the Soviet economy was significantly smaller than the American economy was. We didn't realize this for much of the Cold War. But what that meant was that Soviet military spending was actually a larger percentage of their economy than we realized. So they were more intent on competing by building tanks and submarines and ballistic missiles than we had realized. They were willing to deprive themselves more. China looks at what happened to the Soviet Union and says, we are not going to go down that road. Instead, the Chinese push the development of what they term comprehensive national power. Comprehensive national power, as a concept, is fairly straightforward. It is, how does a country stack up with other countries? Military power is part of it, but as we saw with the Soviet Union, it cannot and should not be the most important part. Economic power is part of it. It provides the sinews for everything else. But as we see with Japan, just because you're the number two economy in the world does not mean you will automatically stay at the top or rise to the top. What else feeds into this? Political unity. If you are not a unified country, you cannot be strong. That has very distinct implications for China's policy towards Taiwan, towards Tibet, towards Xinjiang, towards internal dissent. A country needs to have diplomatic respect. Do people care about what your country thinks? Well, when you're a member of the UN Permanent Five, the answer to that partly is yes. But also, when you are the largest economy, or the second largest economy, or the third largest economy, you have a certain amount of voice. When you have cultural influence, and so the Chinese also talk about cultural security, that's another element of comprehensive national power. And science and technology, because you don't simply want to make t-shirts. You don't simply want to be the, you know, steel mill, the lead smelter, the sweatshop of other people. You want to move up the innovation path. You want to be the inventor, not the licensee. You want to create the patents. And so in all of these areas, China is pushing to develop its capabilities. So with all of these elements in mind, we have a China that is growing, that is more capable, whose comprehensive national power has been steadily expanding over the last 20 years. But over the last 10 years, 6 to 10 years, what we have seen, most worrisomely, is a growing concern and a growing reliance upon the military element by the Chinese. And this goes to the third knot, which is that this is not your father's People's Liberation Army. A couple of things to keep in mind. First and foremost, the People's Liberation Army is a party army. It is not a national army. What do we mean by that? It's very straightforward. Every officer in the People's Liberation Army, above the rank of second lieutenant, is a member of the party. period. You cannot rise above second lieutenant without being a member of the party. If there is some reason you cannot be made a member of the party, thank you very much for your service and your interest in national security. I'm sure you'll have a fine career out there running a joint venture, running a factory, you know, but you will not find your personal future in the PLA. What this also means, of course, is that the PLA is firmly under the control of the party. Sometimes you hear commentary about rogue militaries, that the Chinese military goes off and does things on its own. The reality is that, no, the military and the party are linked together up and down the chain, in part because the party is the military and the military is part of the party. So another aspect of this is that this is not a military that continues to emphasize mass and quantity over quality, but instead is trying to strike a balance. Gone are the days of a PLA that was betting that you would run out of bullets before they ran out of bodies. That may have been true during the Korean War. It may have even been true as recently as the Sino-Vietnam War of 1979, the last war that the Chinese military fought. But today's Chinese military is a very different entity. To begin with, its officer corps is much more professional. This is not a military that thinks, you know, all I need to do is to read the sayings of Chairman Mao and I shall be ever victorious. Again, great propaganda in the 1960s, but today's PLA is a learning organization. It pays extremely close attention to how modern war is fought, in particular in preparing for what the Chinese term local wars under informationized conditions. But this is a military that reads what other people write, in part because it hasn't fought a war since 1979. And so this is a military that has translated American field manuals, American joint publications, American doctrinal statements. And they're very upfront about this. You can find things like the NCO guide, written by an American NCO, translated into Chinese. And the translation is very good. This is not a warped translation. This is not, you know, an ideologically shifted translation. This is a, you know, I mean, every translation will always have a little bit of question, but in the main, it is capturing, we're trying to capture the essence of what it means to be an NCO as we understand it. This is how the PLA is evolving. The second aspect here is that the PLA is not organized like Western militaries. Services are not dominant. When you think about the American military, inevitably, you know, you have folks who will tell you, say, in the fall, you know, go Army or beat Navy, or beat Army, go Navy. And then, of course, you have the Air Force game. The point here being services are a fundamental way that the military, the American military, Western militaries think of themselves. But the Chinese military, first and foremost, is run through something called the Central Military Commission. The Central Military Commission is headed by the chairman of the CMC, who, by the way, also happens to be the party general secretary and the president of the country. Right now, that would be Xi Jinping. So it is headed by a civilian. Underneath are two vice chairmen of the CMC, and these are the senior uniformed officers. The defense minister, by contrast, ranks much further down. The defense minister is the person you meet if you're the secretary of defense or minister of defense, or who comes off the plane and you greet at your airport. But he's not necessarily the senior most military decision maker. The two vice chairmen, in turn, have underneath them four general departments. So these four general departments are responsible for the entire military. The general staff department, war planners, military intelligence, things like that. The General Political Department, responsible for political orthodoxy, political education, but also morale, criminal investigation, psychological warfare, legal warfare, public opinion warfare, the so-called three warfares. They're also responsible for morale issues. They run the Chinese military's newspapers and CCTV7, Chinese military news channel, General Logistics Department, beans, bullets, and blankets, and the General Armaments Department, weapons development. The GAD runs the nuclear weapons development complex, weapons testing, also China's space program. China's space program is run through the military. Only beneath all of that, then do you hit the services. The PLA Navy, the PLA Air Force, and the 2nd Artillery Corps, which runs the nuclear and ballistic missile forces. So you have a very different view if you're in a Chinese uniform, because your first and foremost thinking isn't necessarily what service am I, so much as which of the general departments do I belong to. The PLA in this context has therefore also been evolving its thinking about how to prepare for future wars. Jiang Zemin, who was leader of China from 1992 to 2002, implemented what was known as the two modernizations, to shift the PLA from army building for local wars under modern conditions, think World War II, lots of tanks, lots of planes, lots of ships, to local wars under modern high-tech conditions. Basically, looking at the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, there was the realization that China needed to be able to implement non-symmetric warfare, non-contact warfare, non-linear warfare. And since then, it has evolved further to push for the ability to wage what they term local wars under informationized conditions, the application of information technology to all aspects of military operations. And the PLA must shift from an army focused on quantity to an army focused on quality. An army that is focused on personnel, lots of them, to science and technology and its applications. Hu Jintao, the previous leader of China, has further developed this and given the PLA new marching orders in what are known as the new historic missions. The new historic missions basically is the broad blueprint for what is the PLA supposed to be able to do. And this comprises four broad mission areas. First, provide loyal support to the CCP. Keep the Chinese Communist Party in power. Again, you would think that that would contradict the role of the military, but since this is a party army, there is no contradiction there. Second, safeguard China's national development. This comes in two parts. The first is to preserve national unity. Really what this means is prevent Taiwanese independence. But second of all, is a reminder to the military, you do not have first priority on resources because of what we saw happen with the Soviet Union. So you are still on a diet. Now, it's a much more flexible diet today than it was in the 1990s. You get a lot more calories. But you still do not have first call on all resources. This is not the 1960s when China's economy was essentially a war economy. Third, is to safeguard China's expanding national interests, and the Chinese, and Hu Jintao was fairly explicit about this. Specifically, this meant the space and electromagnetic domains. You, the PLA, must be capable of dominating space, must be capable of dominating cyberspace, and you must be able to prevent an opponent from challenging that. And then finally, to contribute to world peace. Now that sounds a little bit like Paplum, but what this really is talking about is greater participation in international security efforts. Why? Because if the PLA is going to learn how to project power, it needs to do so in a way that doesn't make it look like an imperialist. And the best way to do this is through the United Nations. The Chinese military is the largest contributor to UN peacekeeping operations among the UN permanent five countries. And it has forces now in Haiti, it has forces in Lebanon, it has forces in Cambodia, it has a small force off the Gulf of Aden. And by conducting such peacekeeping operations, it is learning how to sustain forces abroad. How do you get fuel? How do you bring home people who are sick? What happens when you transfer units among various commands? It's doing all of these things, but it is doing it without appearing to be imperialist because, well, we're doing it through blue helmets. Of course, the difference here is really one of scale more than anything else. I've mentioned local wars under informationized conditions a great deal, and so the important thing to keep in mind here is that the PLA in its writings emphasize the importance of establishing what they term information dominance in time of conflict. Information dominance means the ability to acquire, transmit, manage, and exploit information faster, more accurately than an opponent, and preventing an opponent from doing the same. It is seen as a sustained effort. It is something that you have to be doing all the time. You can't assume that you ever permanently have information dominance. But what that also means is that you have to back it out to peacetime. You cannot be sure you can break into an opponent's information networks. You cannot be sure that you can establish space dominance. You cannot be sure that you know the passwords and the routers and the IP addresses if you start at H hour on D-Day. No, you need to establish all of that information long beforehand, during peacetime. And so what this means is that you have a much more blurred concept of peacetime and wartime. Without information dominance, the PLA's writings are very clear. The side that doesn't have information dominance cannot establish air and maritime dominance. The side that can't establish air and maritime dominance will lose. You will lose because you will never be able to seize the initiative. You will lose because you're always in a reactive stance. You will lose because you will basically be bludgeoned to death, and you will have no idea how to respond. And so, you need to be able to do it to the other guy before they do it to you. Fairly straightforward. How do you do this? Key aspects of information dominance are the ability to establish space dominance. Because as the Chinese have seen in our wars from 1991 onwards, we, the US, we, the West, rely on space to gather our information, to transmit our information, to gain things like battle damage assessment, to gain key supporting information like weather. We often underestimate how important weather information is. To guide our weapons. So space dominance is a key component of establishing information dominance. Physical destruction of enemy command and control capabilities, cyber and electronic warfare. And finally, psychological dominance, because at the end of the day, it's not just the computers, the physical hardware, it's not just the bits and bytes, the data that transmits through, but it's the person sitting in front of the screen, the person who is using that information, that is also essential. And so psychological dominance, the ability to impact how people are thinking, is as important as cyber viruses and the rest. So let me conclude here by noting some of the challenges for US-China relations within this broad context. There are economic challenges and there are security challenges. Economically speaking, if the US wants to compete with China, we need to get our own house in order. China, in this regard, wants the US to maintain financial stability because they are tied in to that global trading system, which still relies on the dollar. We, in turn, want China to be part of that system. The US was instrumental in bringing China into the World Trade Organization. The problem is, again, the very different views. We want China to play by the same rules when it comes to intellectual property rights. China's perspective is different. Both sides, unfortunately, have major fiscal problems. And both sides have entrenched interests that, frankly, make it very difficult to deal with that fundamental set of financial problems. We both have very large debt problems. The reality is that we, the US, have a much better sense of our financial problems than I suspect the Chinese may actually even know about their own. The Chinese financial system is largely opaque, but it may well be opaque even in China. And on the security side, and I suppose I probably should have prefaced all of my comments by saying that my background is political military, not economics. But on the security side, three main points. One, while we are facing a rising China, this is not Imperial Germany, much less Nazi Germany. This is not a new power, this is the return of an old power. And so I would suggest that China and the United States, ironically enough, are both status quo powers. The problem is the American status quo is about 250 years old. Not surprisingly, we've been on top most of that time, we like that status quo. China's status quo is 5,000 years old. And unfortunately, the last 250 years have probably been China's weakest in all of those 5,000 years. And so when we say we want to keep the status quo, the Chinese look at that and say, maybe I don't like that. More to the point is, China is used to being the dominant power in Asia, which it was for most of those 5,000 years. Second, China's antagonism is as much aimed at its neighbors as it is towards the United States. The problem is that many of those neighbors are U.S. allies. Japan is obviously one of those countries that China has real problems with. The U.S. is a key ally. And from the Chinese perspective, the U.S. is trying to contain China because China's expectations, China's boundaries, China's interests are within what China feels are its own long-standing legitimate claims. The South China Sea, which has been in the news the last few days, is a good example. From the Chinese perspective, the South China Sea has always been Chinese. It's called the South China Sea. Not surprisingly, the Filipinos call it the West Sea. They don't necessarily accept that. The larger point being, from the Chinese perspective, why are you, the U.S., interfering with China's claims to its long-standing territory? Now, all the other neighbors would vehemently disagree with China, but China doesn't necessarily do a great job of putting itself in other people's shoes. And so, in conclusion, what we face, really more than anything else, is, to borrow a line from Cool Hand Luke, a failure to communicate. And that failure to communicate is not because the two sides aren't trying, but because the two sides are looking at the world from very fundamentally different perspectives. Thank you very much.
Dean, that was great. I've never heard such a quiet audience as they listen to you. So the first question is, looking ahead, this goes back to your last point, what do you think is the most dangerous potential conflict in Asia? Would it be China and Taiwan, China and a more nationalistic Japan, or something else?
This is one of those interesting questions where if you were to plot it out on a graph, you have the most likely and the most destructive, and those are very different. I would actually suggest that the most likely conflict is probably somewhere in the South China Sea, and it will involve China and one of the claimants to the Spratlys or to any of the other little sand spits out there, but probably not the Philippines, because the Philippines is a U.S. ally. And I don't believe that the Chinese really want their first war, if it were to happen, if things were to escalate out of control, their first war in 35 years to be against the single most combat experienced military in the world. So I would say that the most likely flashpoints are areas controlled by Vietnam or areas controlled by Malaysia, because neither of those countries has a great power patron outside. The second most likely, because you have military forces operating in close proximity, is in fact the Senkakus, the territories that are disputed between Japan and China. Because there, you have a lot of history influencing people's perspectives, a willingness to maybe go to the mattresses over a piece of territory that is claimed by a long-standing enemy. The most dangerous, of course, is Taiwan. Because Taiwan fundamentally represents, for the Chinese, a regime survival issue. The CCP almost certainly cannot survive if Taiwan were to successfully break away from the mainland. So that's the three most likely. Now I'll throw one wild card out there. The Chinese recently sent forces across the border into India. Not a large force, only about a company in size, 80 or 90 people. Soldiers, not backpackers, not civilians, not park rangers. And this is the third time they've done it. And for those of you who are familiar with Ian Fleming, he once made the observation, Mr. Bond, the first time is happenstance, the second time is coincidence, but the third time, The third time, Mr. Bond is enemy action. And so in April, and then subsequently in May, Chinese forces, again about in company size, rolled into India, marched about 20 miles in, set up camp, stayed there for a week, got resupplied, which is why they probably didn't get lost. They might have gotten lost, but the guys who were flying the helicopters and driving the trucks probably knew where they were. And now they've done it again. So China has a very different perspective on risk-taking because India has nuclear weapons. I would submit that the idea of American forces going into East Germany in 1987 and camping out for a week and being resupplied, or for that matter, Soviet forces going into Germany, war Norway, war Turkey for a week, was something that nobody would have been willing to risk. And yet we see that today, in 2014, between China and India.
Here's a question that is something of a follow-up, because it's about India. To what extent are differences with India a driver or concern to China? In other words, what's behind all this military action from China's perspective?
The Chinese-Indian border remains a festering sore. And the funny thing about it is that it is the only land border that I believe at this point that hasn't been resolved, because the Chinese and the Soviets, and now the Russians, signed a series of agreements that pretty much resolved their border disputes. So from the Amur and Ussuri rivers up in the northeast all the way through Kazakhstan and the other stands, those land borders have been resolved. But the Sino-Indian border has not been. And the McMahon line, which imagine you took a map where 1 inch equals 500 miles, you took a magic marker and marked the border. You might have a few mountains and valleys and even towns that fell under that magic marker, and now that you have GPS and you can determine things down to the inch, you might sort of say, you know, that valley, that town, that mountain is mine. And it's like, oh, no, it's on our side of that magic marker, if you could parse it that way. So that's part of the issue. I mean, the funny thing is that you have two countries, India and China, that are very significant trading partners for each other, but you also have a large military on each side, and the fact that China is aligned with Pakistan, Pakistan's biggest patron, if you will, military patron, is in fact China, presents the Indian government with the ugly possibility of a two-front war, Pakistan on the one side, China on the other, or even a three-front war, if you think the Chinese Navy might play a role in the Indian Ocean. So,
okay, all right. Well, here's a follow-up on the Taiwan issue. I've got a couple of questions. The first one is straightforward. Why does China need Taiwan? And the other one is, why can't the CCP survive if China breaks away? In other words, is there something really important about Taiwan, or is it just symbolic?
Well, symbolic things are important. Anybody here a Red Sox fan?
No, Orioles.
Anybody care if the Red Sox never won a World Series, ever? You know? What? It's a baseball game. It's a game, right? It's a bunch of people running around with a stick and a ball. And yet, how much money is that worth? How many electrons are spent? How many pages have been spent? I was a grad student in Boston for a little while. I remember, this was before the Red Sox winning, they had one elderly gentleman come out. This was in 86, bad year. All I want is to see the Red Sox win one more time before I die. I think he was quite sincere and earnest. The point here is, one, symbols matter. Two, for China, Taiwan is symbolic, and it goes to something the Chinese term the century of humiliation. In 1842, Britain launched what is known as the Opium War. It essentially was forcing China to accept Indian opium for sale in China, because China was trying to restrict drugs in its own country, and China lost. So imagine if the Colombian cartels had fought a war with the United States and won. And now, when you order a Coke at McDonald's, they ask you how many grams you want. oh, and by the way, every dollar that is spent is going to go to Colombia. That was the beginning of a century that saw Hong Kong made a British colony, that saw Japan invade China several times, that saw Taiwan taken away from China. So from the Chinese perspective, Taiwan is a lot like Hong Kong. It is something that is much more than just a symbol. And for the same reason, this is why the CCP cannot survive, because the CCP's legitimacy is in part rooted in the idea that no one will ever do to China what happened during the Century of Humiliation. And if you think of the CCP's legitimacy as resting on a couple of different pillars, when it was created, it had three pillars. It had, we are going to create a new society where everyone is equal, communism. We will create a country that is economically vibrant, your children will live better than you. And we will create a country that is strong, and no one will ever do these things to us again. Well, as I said in my remarks, the idea of communism is dead and gone. The economy today is weak, is on shaky terms. It may recover, it may not, but at this moment in time, not so clear. So you've gone from a tricycle to a bicycle to a unicycle. A unicycle is not the most stable platform out there.
All right, I've got a number of questions about North Korea, too. To what extent does the Chinese military influence North Korea's military, or be concerned about their neighbors' unpredictable antics? Here's another one. What's China's long-range objective with North Korea? How is support for North Korea's aggressive stance in China's best interest?
The Chinese used to say that their relations with North Korea were as close as lips and teeth. Today, if you go with that analogy, they are as close as lips and that really cup of gross water that your grandma's dentures sat in on the nightstand. North Korea is a problem child for China. It is an economic basket case. It is a country that Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, and Hu Jintao went and talked with the North Korean leader, Kim Il-sung, followed by Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un, and each case has said, you need to implement economic reform, not political reform. We're not asking you to do anything we wouldn't do, but to open up to markets, open up to private sales, things like that. And in each case, the North Korean leadership said, take a long walk off of, not as nice a pier as is in Camden and Rockport. From the Chinese perspective, why do they care about North Korea? Several things. First and foremost, you don't need 10 million refugees coming across the border. Second of all, North Korea's nuclear weapons are not aimed at China. For a lot of Asia, for a lot of the world, think of the movie The Fugitive. If you remember, Tommy Lee Jones is standing off against Harrison Ford, and Harrison Ford says, I didn't kill my wife, and Tommy Lee Jones says, I don't care. This is the point. From the Chinese perspective, North Korean nuclear weapons, they don't really affect China. North Korea is not going to nuke Beijing. But North Korea will use those nuclear weapons to keep itself in power, which from the Chinese perspective is slightly problematic, but not especially so. And finally, in terms of support, the thing to keep in mind is China is the number two economy in the world. It could make North Korea a lot better off than it has. China keeps North Korea on life support. And in fact, my colleague at the Heritage Foundation, Bruce Kleiner, has observed that when other countries increase their aid to North Korea, China decreases its aid. When other countries reduce their aid, China increases it. It's as though the Chinese said, okay, you know, here's this level that'll limit the number of refugees, that'll keep your country afloat. You're not gonna get rich, you're certainly not gonna get fat, but you won't collapse. And we'll basically keep you at that allowance. So, a problem child that the Chinese are stuck with.
Okay, now we're going to a much more important neighbor. What is China's foreign policy relationship with Russia?
Chinese-Russian relations, I would suggest, are a matter of shared antipathies rather than mutual sympathies. These are two countries that don't trust each other, that have a long negative history with each other, but they trust the United States even less. And so, for example, there's something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is comprised of Russia, China, and most of the STANs, most of the Central Asian countries. And the point of the SCO, more than anything else, is to keep the US out of Central Asia. Some people say that it's a Sino-Russian NATO. Not really. But it is a Sino-Russian front to make sure the US does not play a larger role than it does and than it needs to. Russia arguably needs China much more than China needs Russia. And especially with President Putin's actions with regards to natural gas and the like, in the wake of Ukraine, Russia really is looking to export things to China as foreign markets close to it. China looks at Russia as basically, yeah, you guys thought you were really top dog back during the Cold War. You talk down to us all the time. Well, look who's laughing now. And so they are happy to buy Russian items after a lot of hard bargaining. Russia does have some weapons that China would be happy to buy. And weapons parts are even more important, jet engines for fighter aircraft. But in the main, China looks at Russia as a country that covers a lot of its northern border, and it doesn't need problems up there. So they have, to coin a phrase, détente. They work with each other when the issue matters to them both, like Syria. Syria didn't really matter except to say to the Americans, no, the UN is not going to rubber stamp yet another fight to democratize. Sorry, we're going to veto that one together. But in lots of other places, the two trust each other like two scorpions in a bottle.
All right, now we're going to move to two other scorpions in a bottle. We're talking about Chinese-US relations. Now, this is a hypothetical question. Suppose China were to take the Senkaku Islands, what should be the U.S. response? I guess, first of all, since that's hypothetical, is that likely? Can you foresee that happening?
Well, it sort of depends on your definition of take. The Senkakus are a group of uninhabited islands that have no fresh water. That's very important. That's not particularly news. Most of the little sand spits down in the South China Sea also have no source of fresh water. So taking an island in terms of putting boots on the ground and raising a flag is one thing. Keeping those boots on the ground is a different issue. Because while you might be able to put people there, at some point you're going to have to resupply them. And resupplying them means it's a game of chicken at that point. Am I willing to resupply them? Are you willing to try and stop me? The U.S. State Department has enunciated a very consistent position on this for the last three or four administrations, actually dating back further, but has reiterated this position explicitly through at least the last three administrations, which is that the Senkakus are under the administrative control of Japan and therefore are covered under the U.S.-Japan Mutual Defense Treaty. So our treaty obligations state that if those islands are seized by a third party, the U.S. is expected to consult with Japan and to, through all the requisite congressional and other authorizations, because no treaty is self-fulfilling. I have friends who are lawyers, they always say, you gotta say that, so that's my little legal disclaimer there. But essentially, we are committed to assisting Japan. Should we do so? That depends. How important is that alliance structure in Asia and around the world? Because if the U.S. does not do that, then this is not a, well, if we don't help Ukraine, who isn't a NATO member, things might look bad. Or should we intervene in Syria, which certainly isn't a member of any U.S.-associated alliance? This is a formal alliance. You break that, no other alliance partner is going to think the U.S. word is worth the paper it's written on. And longer term, what do you think Japan would do Let's say China takes the islands in this hypothetical. The U.S. says, you know what, not my problem. Do we think Japan is then going to say, oh, well, okay, since Uncle Sam's not going to be here, here, China, sign it over, let me give it to you. Or do you think maybe Japan might respond? Might Japan respond by saying, okay, I can't take those islands today, but I have a very good technological base. I can develop nuclear weapons. I can develop a more assertive military. I can retake those islands. What does that do? And because Asia has no overarching security architecture, what do you think the South Koreans would do if Japan went down that path? What do you think the rest of Southeast Asia might do if Japan went down that path? And of course, what do you think the rest of Southeast Asia would do if the U.S. walked away from a treaty commitment and you had a China that was now openly aggressive? So you open up all sorts of really ugly cans of worms if you say, you know what, I don't care.
Okay, well, here is something of a follow-on. We had John Mearsheimer here earlier this summer, and he said that U.S. needs to oppose the rise of any regional hegemony. Should we be opposed to China as a regional hegemony, and if so, how?
I find myself in the interesting position of agreeing with John Mearsheimer. The U.S. has been interested in Asia since the founding of the Republic. The first ship to leave American shores, flying the American flag, was a ship named the Empress of China in 1784, part of the China trade. So we have always been interested in Asia. And since the earliest days of our global engagement, we have opposed the rise of a hegemon in Asia, even more than in Europe. The open door policy towards China was implemented to prevent Europe from closing off China as a market. We imposed the oil and steel embargoes on Japan, which led to Pearl Harbor, because Japan was intent on taking over China. We forged the wagon wheel of alliances to prevent the Soviets from dominating Asia. We welcomed China into the WTO to help prevent the rise of a single hegemon. So it is consistent with two centuries of American policy to oppose any single country from being the dominant hegemon over Asia. And it's important to recognize that in the course of doing so, the U.S. did not create a closed system. The U.S. created a system where all of the countries in Asia could expand their own economies, could trade. We are the importer of last resort. We are a big, huge reason why South Korea is the economy it is today. Japan became the economy it is today in terms of the 1960s and 1970s. Thailand, Hong Kong, all of these, is because we did not create a closed system. We said, no other country can be hegemon, we're it, and you will just work with us. We said, we want an open system throughout Asia, trade with the world. Let's just keep those sea lanes open. Let's keep access open. Let's keep the markets open.
Okay, well, here's the same question sort of rephrased. Do you see any difference between our Monroe Doctrine and what China aspires to do in Asia and the South China Sea?
The Monroe Doctrine basically said that Europe would not be allowed to come in and essentially recolonize Central and South America. And the exercise of it, for example, in the crisis with Germany in 1902, had to do with the Germans basically saying that they had a right to come in to collect debts, which was not actually something we necessarily had a problem with, and in order to maintain that debt collection would take over essentially a couple of the Central American countries. That, I would suggest, is a somewhat different attitude than what the Chinese are saying, which is, in the first place, the Chinese are claiming the equivalent of the entire Caribbean is the 51st through the 53rd states. I would say that that's a somewhat different perspective than the Monroe Doctrine. Second of all, I'm not really sure who the questioner or the Chinese would say is trying to come in and colonize East and Southeast Asia. Third is that in the cases of places like British Guiana and the Dutch Antilles, places that were already under that control were not eliminated. And here the comparison is that we have alliances with Thailand, with South Korea, with Japan. As we showed in the late 1980s, if you want to end that alliance, all you have to do is say, we want out. The Filipinos said, you know what, thanks very much, but Subic and Clark, we want them back. And we said, okay, and we left. Today, the Filipinos are saying, you know, with those Chinese there and our military being the weakest in Asia, we'd like you to come back. And now we're in negotiations. But the point is, if these countries feel like this is a Monroe Doctrine, that China is their patron, that China is their supporter, that China is going to protect them, Bangkok is welcome to say, you know what, United States, Thanet Rusk was is a relic of the Cold War, hasta la vista. Well, actually, they would probably say it in Thai, but I don't speak Thai. And they don't. In fact, Asia is very clear. They want the United States to stay. Singapore, our other friends and allies in the region say, we want a larger American presence. So in the context of the Monroe Doctrine, I would say that you're not quite talking apples and sofas, but maybe apples and kumquats.
All right, here is a much more narrow question. You know, there was an incident a couple of days ago in which a U.S. plane, I think a Chinese fighter, came within 30 feet of a U.S. plane. So the question is, what's this all about? Why is China doing it? And suppose a Chinese fighter brings down a U.S. plane, accidentally crashes into it. What's this all about?
Well, on the second part of the question, you don't have to suppose. It happened. April 2001, an EP-3 U.S. patrol aircraft flying in the rough same area as this incident involving a U.S. P-8 had a collision with a Chinese JA-2 Finback fighter. The Chinese fighter plane was maneuvering extremely unsafe. I'm going to assume a lot of you folks here are sailors. So the P-3 is a four-engine turboprop. It is a slow aircraft. The Chinese fighter aircraft operated fundamentally in a way that, in terms of seamanship, you know, who has the right of way? It's the less maneuverable ship, if I remember right.
It's the sailboat always has a right of way.
Okay. There might be people here who flew P-3s, and to compare it to a sailboat would needlessly antagonize people. So, but the point here is that the Chinese fighter operated in an extraordinarily dangerous way, and in this case, it lost. And the plane went down, the pilot was killed, or at least he was never recovered. And the plane, our plane, the American plane, came down on Hainan Island. The crew survived. The plane itself was an excellent example of fine piloting to bring that plane down. When you look at that plane, it was like, how the heck did they do that? And the Chinese held it for about a week, and then eventually the crew was returned, and then much later the plane was returned. So this has happened. What was going on? Between then and now, we've had a number of such incidents, both in the air and at sea. Some of you may have heard the name USNS Impeccable. It's a Tagos-class ship, basically a sonar ship doing oceanographic research. The Chinese sent fishing boats and other ships to harass it. USNS Victorious, USS John S. McCain III, most recently the USS Cowpens. All of these are ships that have run into incidents where the Chinese basically maneuvered extraordinarily dangerously around them, trying to grab the towed array sonars, trying to force the ships out of the sea space. This aircraft incident is not the first, it's not the only one, it's the same sort of thing. The Chinese attitude is, if you're a civilian airliner, United Airlines flight such and so, going from Tokyo to Hanoi, that's your business. That's fine. File the flight plan, that's fine. But a military aircraft or a military ship, if you want to go through what the Chinese claim as their waters, and in this case it's extending 200 nautical miles out. So this is not territorial air and sea space as understood under international law. This is how the Chinese think about it. If you want to do that, you need to turn off your radars. We'll let you leave a navigation radar on safety. You need to not engage in intelligence gathering. You need to not be listening in. And you need to tell us that you're coming, and you need to tell us where you are, and you need to tell us when you're leaving. This fundamentally violates freedom of navigation. This fundamentally violates customary and traditional maritime law and international maritime law. And the Chinese attitude is, guess what? We're rewriting that. Because we can. Or they want us to believe that they can. And so that is what this comes down to, is freedom of navigation on the one side, and the Chinese view that this is their territorial air and sea space on the other.
Okay, unfortunately, we're way over time, but I'm going to ask one more question anyway. And this is looking into China's future. Will China be a one-party country still by, and the question says, 2050, 2030? What's the future of China's from a political point of view?
I feel like Karnak the Magnificent. I would say that as of 2030, yeah. Okay. The Chinese will remain a one-party system so long as the CCP remains in power, which means that the CCP has no real interest in political reform. And in fact, Xi Jinping, the new leader, people held out real big hope that he would implement political reform, and at this point you don't hear that anymore. He's only been in office for about a year, but there's no evidence that he's going to pursue any of that. And he will be there through 2022. So if China were going to become democratic by 2030, that means that all of a sudden you're going to have a crop of senior leaders who are already very senior, who would be saying, yeah, we're going to push for democracy in 8 years. Probably not going to happen. The larger point is, how will China handle all of the domestic unrest and instability that it already confronts? And my guess is, unfortunately, that that means more repression, not democratization. 2050 is a long time away. I think it was Yogi Berra who said the future's hard to predict, especially because it hasn't happened yet. But in the case of China, what we do see is a system that has made no real start towards democratization. Now, the Chinese will say China is not ready for democracy. India, with 1.1 to 1.2 billion people, is a democracy, so it's probably not about numbers. And Taiwan is, although many people who support Taiwan independence will say it's not, Taiwan certainly has a lot of Chinese on it, and they seem to be able to be a democracy. So I would suggest that the CCP's reluctance to shift towards democracy has everything to do with being a vanguard party. But that transition won't be easy, won't be smooth, and may well, as we see in Iraq and we see in Afghanistan and we see throughout most of the Arab world, which is not obvious, it's the same culturally, but still. The path to democracy is not easy and often doesn't happen at all. So I would say that I'm very, very pessimistic even in a 2050 time frame, which isn't to say I wouldn't like to see it happen, just to say I wouldn't bet on it.
Well, that's food for thought. This was a terrific talk, Dean. We really appreciate it. And to show you how much we appreciate it, we're going to give you a very famous mug. You'll be the first person at the Heritage Foundation to have this. So I assume you'll display it appropriately. The Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.